Nebenstimmen. A podcast by Ensemble Modern. Nebenstimmen brings you conversations on music, art and life between ensemble members and conversation partners chosen by them. Find out what the musicians are working on at the moment and what their personal thoughts are.
Welcome to Nebenstimmen. I'm Paul Cannon. Today I'm joined by the experimental electronic musician, composer, and well-known YouTuber, Hainbach. We're releasing a brand new album together on the Ensemble Modern label called Primer. We'll get into that project in a little bit, but first I have some questions. Hainbach, I've watched quite a few of your YouTube videos, probably more than I should admit to having watched, and I find them endlessly fascinating and actually very inspiring. I'd like to get your version of what is the basic idea of that channel? What's it about?
There is what it started out and what it has become. It's a constant transformation because I recently checked what was the first video that I would say is the first video where I had the intention of like making this something regular. And that's in 2016, and it's called Improvisation Over a Chord, which is just 10 minutes of me improvising over a chord with my electronic musical instruments. And I put up the camera basically to not sit down and make this a finished track, but just improvise and see what happens. And from that moment on, I started doing that more. Because the thing that happens when you're sitting down and in a studio is it's very result-orientated. You're like, sit down, make a track, something you can release. But I wanted to get better at improvising electronic music because when I came to Berlin, it was wonderful. Like, I would play the afternoon with a band, a rehearsal. Then I would take my modular, which is a huge collection of, not a huge, but like kind of a collection of little modules that all make sound connected by patch cables. And then I would go to a bar and somebody would say, what's that? Oh, that's a modular synthesizer. Oh, can you play something? And then I would like play for drinks, basically, for an hour or two. And then happy, I would go home. And on the way home, there was a gallery and there would be an experimental turntable list. And I was like, oh, you want to join? I said, okay, cool. So, and that was like, that was Berlin for me at the time. There was a whole scene of Echtzeitmusik, real-time music. And my goal since I got there was to be a good improviser on my electronic instruments. And that was a marked difference from the times that I had before where I played in bands. And in bands, you're just constantly repeating the same thing. You learn it and then you play it 100 times. And that bored me. That really bored me. So this freedom of getting good improvisation was important. But coming from that world, same problem applied. I would sit down, make something that would be releasable. So the YouTube channel was for me a way out of that. I would put up the camera and the camera and the audience would be my live audience. I would do a live rehearsal because I also don't like to rehearse just by myself. I find that incredibly boring. I just really like to have some way to either with people, because I used to play in bands, so rehearsing with people.
Right, I mean, you need an audience.
Yeah, like, I mean. And you feed people, it's like people to bounce off. And when you're sitting there lonely with your electronic instruments, it's very, who are you feedbacking with? Who are you feeding off? And what's your, like, it's where's your sense to continue? So the camera, 30 minutes, that was all the recording time I had on that cheap camera. Put that up there and played a set in the morning, played a set in the afternoon, set in the morning, set in the afternoon. And I was working on a theater play, a soundtrack for that in Weimar at the time. Mm. And those early those recordings became the Weimar sessions, and those were the start of my YouTube channel because people really appreciated those like 30 minutes of ambient, odd, experimental music. And from there on, I started just then also posting pieces that I made, usually in the same way that I improvise, something that's where I know what I'm doing, that's rehearsed, but then I'm able to break free. So it's all these just 3 minute, 5 minute little music videos I put up for a year. And by that time, so I had probably about 10,000 people following me at that time from the music alone. I had gotten like a lot of questions because none of the instruments I was playing were common. They were all
right.
These weird little electronic wooden boxes friends of mine made, or modded toy instrument, toy instruments. At that time, not so much vintage because I couldn't afford anything.
Yeah, fair enough.
So like, this is like if it was like it was just it was. I was on a strict diet of instruments. Mm. So one good electronic instrument. One pricey one, and I would have to learn that. So, and that was, I just get good at playing that.
But you know, that's something I really enjoy with a lot of your videos, that you focus on one particular instrument, and it very often I wouldn't immediately recognize it as an instrument. I remember one of the first videos I saw of you, you were playing a I think it was a printer. It was this thing you called it the saddest drone.
Ah, the saddest drone machine. That's where the printer thing comes from, because I was wondering why in all the concert description there was the talk about Soviet printers that I was using. I was like, no, okay, that's not a printer, but that's an ISDN protocol testing unit.
Okay,
so
but this is the thing, you took this old machine, which was never meant to be an instrument.
No,
and. You explained in the video that you were hoping it would have lots of bleeps and bloops and it would do something.
Yeah.
And finally, it only made two kinds of sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then your challenge was to make a whole track or a whole piece out of these two sounds. Mm-hmm. So that's really what I love about the channel very often is there's this kind of focus,
mm-hmm.
but also this very playful attitude about where can you go with very limited material?
Mm.
Which is that's somehow confusing, because when I see videos of your performances, especially in your own studio, you have all this stuff and it's like unlimited possibilities in a way. So I don't know if I have a question in there. It's just
I mean, everybody who's got like an iPad or an iPhone has already unlimited musical possibilities.
Exactly.
There's so much possibility in that it's just always the same interface. So it's the same interface, like you write a message, the same interface you order food, the same interface you get a taxi, the same interface you watch Netflix on. And I've got a lot of things in my studio, but many of them are pretty dumb. There are things that just go beep or beep or boop, and that's all they do. But they've got a nice big dial, and that dial, enables you to go from beep to beep. It's a very subtle difference,
yeah.
But it's there. And then you have a whole world to discover, especially if that dial is connected to a scientific filter that was meant to be used in a nuclear research laboratory where you're trying to figure out tiny fluctuations in voltage hidden under a huge amount of noise in a particle accelerator, for example. And when you aim that on like a musical signal, on like a piano chord, you find all these overtones and things that are hidden, and suddenly there's a whole new nugget of inspiration to be had, a new sound, a new melody, just from aiming that dial, that filter on that thing and basically blasting it with so much gain, like impossible amounts of gain, for way more than any musical equipment has. And you look into it and you break up the sound. It's like a musical treasure hunt in a way.
Yeah, but you still have a very good taste with it.
Well, thank you.
I mean, it's not only about, okay, you have all this stuff, But you're able quite quickly to find something useful, something musical, and that's something I really appreciate. I'm curious, when did you start collecting? Because I've been in your house, and it's almost like walking into. I don't mean to be insulting, but it's a bit like walking into a child's idea of a mad scientist's laboratory.
Yeah,
it's just wall to wall packed with. Like nuclear test equipment and old synthesizers and tons of stuff. And it's very overwhelming. It makes for a beautiful set, but you actually use all this stuff.
Yeah.
But when did you start collecting these objects?
That was another evolution of the YouTube channel, because when I, after posting all those music videos, I got a lot of questions about the instruments that I use.
Right.
And then I started to talk on camera about them. And that was, at first I thought this was the worst decision I've ever made, because talking on a camera in English was like, this is the hardest thing I've ever done. And when you see the first videos, I'm talking like this, like a robot. Right. And now I touch the filter and I'm like, what am I doing? What am I doing here? But people enjoyed it. And apparently a German accent is for electronic music very good. So I kept on doing that. And from there on, that quickly led to like coming into a world and into a place where people enjoyed all the crazy ideas I had. They hyped them up. They enjoyed them. And I was able to start making a living from the YouTube channel also, because my main job at the time was composing for theater, which is also a wonderful job to explore all kinds of things. But from there, the stranger things I got into, and the more absurd the things I would tackle, the more people would cheer me on. And then I got into the test equipment world, tape and test equipment world, which is something I had seen before. I'd learned about it in my studies. I studied musicology in Hamburg, where we learned about, of course, the early electronic music studios, what they did there. But of course, I was interested in that, but I thought, okay, this is very impractical. And at that time, I lived in a 14 square meter flat, like a WG Zimmer. So there was not much space for any of that. And I didn't even know what would be things to get and where to get them. But that aside, when I discovered that world again of tape and test equipment, I said, I'm just going to try that. And people cheered me on. And I made a little thing. Oh, I have a little corner here reserved for some little sine generators and some little tools meant for testing, like radio frequency stuff, and see what you can make with them. It was bleep, bloop, bleep,
but
bloop.
But that was still before the YouTube channel.
No,
right?
It was still in the YouTube channel. Then there was just that happened like in.
Oh, it really happened side by side.
Side by side to the YouTube channel. And all these explorations, like they are like, that was one thing that was like really fire, like it was something that interested me. And thanks to the people that supported me on YouTube and on my Patreon, I was able to just go nuts and just try to find all this stuff really cheap. I bought the cheapest things. That's where I bought the saddest drone machine, which was that ISDN tester.
Right.
I bought all these things like for nothing, because they were thrown out. It was all obsolete equipment. And I bought boxes and boxes and boxes for nothing. But then putting them together and trying to assemble an instrument. I did statues out of them, so much stuff I had. that was all due to this feedback system I had developed with the audience on YouTube. And then I released records with these, and these records did well. They were really like records that then got like synced for films and stuff. And people really enjoyed the music that I made with these things. And it's very natural. It grew out of that.
Nice. So when you're in like the composition process, and I don't know if you even think of it as composing or if well, I,
it is.
That,
it
actually,
is.
That's my question: is do you find that the use of these instruments or these items? Whatever it is you have in front of you, is that what's guiding your compositional process, or do you have a different starting point?
So I don't really like my own ideas so much.
Okay.
I don't like what's in my head. I'm not interested in that, but I like discovering things. And I think there's something where some similarities to Chelsea, which is like the inspiration for the next thing that we're doing together, is because he had a more like esoteric approach where he was like the medium and that all sound was already there, and he created conditions where things would happen. And I was like, oh yeah, I can identify with that, because I think the music that I want to do is already there. I just have to find it. And that's why I really enjoy a playful approach. Everything comes to me from play. Like, the first thing with every composition I do is basically the arrangement. So which instrument paired with that could produce a result that I find interesting? And I let these collide. I let the instruments like clash and play together, and everything, every little piece I do, every composition it's an experiment. At least these are the ones that are the most fun to me. I can do stuff that's like built by, how do you say, the Handwerk, the craft of composing. I can, okay, this chord, this chord, this chord, this chord, this chord. I can do that too. And that can be fun, like as a thing, you know, there's a singer, I have to write a piece for them, I'm going to do it like this, or there's this. I've done all that like for my composition work. But the most fun and the most creative ideas I have is when I set up these little experiments of instrument pairings and interaction with either the instruments that I've set up or the players and the instrument. Yeah, that's where, for me, the most exciting music happens. I see myself as someone who like prepares like conditions of play.
Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Let's talk about Primer, our new album. This is a recording of a live set in our Checkpoint series here in the house of the Ensemble Moderne. Mm-hmm. So you did this with us, with eight members of the ensemble, back in 2022.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine, I mean, maybe not, but I can imagine coming here for the first time. For a lot of people, actually, it can be a bit scary or at least challenging. Did you have...
Did you guys scare me?
That wasn't quite what I was getting at, but if you want to answer that question first, go ahead.
Did we? No, it's kind of the thing. I mean, like, of course, there's a huge respect for you guys, but yeah. We talked, and I was like, yeah, okay,
sure,
we can talk with that guy, and if the rest of like that, I've got a great chance to play with great musicians, and that's one of the best things. So I was more excited,
mm-hmm,
and I left it. So for that, the concept was very open. The playground was very wide open. I thought, okay, this is mainly about us playing together and improvising together.
Yeah.
That was one of the main things I was really interested in, because I really wanted to, like, I'm going to play with some of the best improvisers on this planet. Come on, this is what I really, really want to do. And the conditions were that I would take all the basic ideas from you, and I would still structure it in a way that feels akin to how I improvise. So I put you in the conditions that I improvise in. So yeah, that was the whole thing.
That's exactly what it felt like. Can you remember a bit how we built that up?
Yes.
How it was structured?
I had to write like a little like letter about myself, how I improvise, so you would have like something, and you'd have like a booklet for people to read what the performance is about.
Yeah.
And that was hard. That was... Because I've got after all these years of improvising, I've got my own way, how I do things, very much internalized. And they feel absolutely, this mm-hmm works for me. And I've tested that time and time again on many stages. But then to put that into words and a framework that will work with others is a challenge. And it felt like writing about yourself and your own music is cringy. It's hard.
Yeah, right,
it can be very hard, but I came up with a thing, and I wrote that down and I sent it to you, and I never looked at it for a long time again, because, oh my God. And I had to, like, for the release of this, I had to look at it again. I was like, oh, that wasn't actually that bad.
Not at all.
It was just...
This was this hypnagogic logic
Hypnagogic logic, which means like everything is structured according to the logic of a brain that's just about to fall asleep.
Yeah.
So when the world drifts away and everything feels incredibly important but impossible to grasp, and it makes absolute sense, but it is absolutely nonsensical. But still, the pull that it has and the allure of it is extremely there. So that's the guiding principle. It has to have this kinder unlogic logic and this intensity.
I think what we ended up doing was definitely in that direction, but it also took a bit of a dark turn. So this is someone who's maybe having some nightmares here and there.
Yeah.
There's some very light moments as well. There's some very sweet moments.
Yeah.
But I'm getting ahead of myself, actually.
Yeah.
So the actual process of the concert, as I recall, was it's not like you came with a score or something like that. Instead, you came with a blank tape loops.
Exactly.
And you recorded us first improvising.
I gave, basically, I said like little ideas. So I thought like, so this, I showed you how the tape works. And that was cool. I've still got video of you guys looking at the tape. Like, oh, okay. That was something I didn't know. I thought, okay, this is like the ensemble. It's around since 1980.
Exactly. So the ones who are from 1980 have seen this before.
Yeah, I thought they would have worked more with tape loops. But I think at the time, tape loops were on their way out.
Maybe.
So it wasn't really an experience that was like shared, and many of the ensemble like, oh, what? The turns around there. It was fun to see interact with like the physicality of the tape, and then trying out to be like the tape. So there was one fun. So there was one improvisation where you suggested that you would try to play backwards, like how it sounds like, to imitate how stuff sounds backwards on the tape after listening to it. Oh, can we play backwards?
Right, this
yeah, and you tried very hard to sound like something backwards on tape, and then I flipped that and it sounded nothing like backwards tape. Sounded exactly not like. It's the same as when you try to say like something backwards by spelling out the word.
Right.
So it's completely wrong. but still like the result is then different. It sounds different. It's not just reverse played backwards. It's a new thing.
It's transformed. So,
it's transformed. And this process is something that we looked into a lot when we improvised these tape loops that we based the performance on, because it was improvised, but it had a guidance to it. And those were the tape loops. And that was so interesting to see what we came up with, how the sound blended. At some points, it was impossible to see what's the tape loop, what's you.
Right, because you're playing back samples of us.
Exactly.
And then asking us to improvise over ourselves.
Yeah.
So in the live performance, we were using these tape loops, and I don't think there was much of a plan. You had five or six.
Oh, we had a run through, which I went like an order, and I messed that up. That happens always. It's going to happen probably like this time too. Because every time I'm usually not at all worried when I play alone. When I play solo, I'm very much okay. But when I play with others, I get like, I get a little bit more excited. I get a little bit more stage frighty and a little bit more especially if there are moments that are like, okay, now we planned this.
Right.
Okay. So at one point I mixed up a tape loop, but that was fine. That was totally fine because you guys flipped on a dime. Okay, now we're here. And then something new happened, and there were things that, of course, that never happened during the rehearsals, because once you have an audience there, things change.
Sure. And I mean, it's very freely improvised. So there's only so much you can plan in advance before you start having to write things down and having something like a chart in front of you. But there was something so special about that concert for me, and that really sits with me as a very... very nice experience of live improvisation, that we were able to compose a piece, and we were really in this mindset that you set up. So it wasn't just you as a musician. It was also just your vibe, as it were, that, you know, we're so used to working with composers or conductors who, you know, they're very serious and they're very precise with their scores and whatever. And we have a certain way of working that we're totally used to, and it's absolutely normal and professional. But it's hard, and it can be on the harsh side if you're not used to it. And then to have someone like you come in for a few days and just jam with this attitude of, like, anything we did, your instant reaction would be, oh, that's cool. Oh, what a nice thing. That's amazing. Yeah. And it was so positive that by the time we got to the concert, I think we all had kind of gotten built up a little bit of, like, yeah, I think we can kind of just do anything and it's going to be great, which isn't true. That's the lie you have to tell yourself before you improvise, that, oh, not only am I going to be fine, like, I can't make a mistake because everything is good. But somehow you got us into this frame of mind, and there's gold in that. So, and you know, I don't mean to sound overly arrogant about that, because it's not just me on the album. So many things that came out of each of the players that are just absolutely brilliant moments, and I think you deserve a lot of credit for that, actually. But now, if we're talking about the live performance, but now we have to talk about the album,
yes,
which is not the same.
No.
And my first question is: would someone who attended that concert, would they recognize?
I think the album. So I think they would. They would have. Because the way memory works is memory fades, and they're not gonna remember every moment, but they're gonna remember, like, the biggest moments or the calmest moments, the loudest moments. And when you hear, like, something like Primer, like the title track, with Sava's fantastic like solo.
Well, that's a little known secret. If you tell Sava to take a solo, it's just going to be genius.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I wrote it in a new one.
Okay. Very clever.
Yeah, of course. so like that, like, if that happened, like, there's so if you look at, that's how it was, because what we did in the album process was, I really wanted to make this not sound like a regular live recording. That was my absolute intention. In mixing, my goal was to make this has to be like a record that can stand on its own. And that means, like, using effects. Like, I had a space echo on one channel, and there we had a big spring reverb on the other, and drums, like, add the overdrive. Come on, make it heavy. Get the bass up. And then you can buy, and then, okay, this part here, that's cool. What if it's here, and we have it here too? So we would cut and paste things together in parts that we really liked and parts that we didn't like. Because in improvisation, like, the one thing that happens is you oftentimes blend between pieces.
Yeah, there's always going to be a few moments of, exactly. And what are we doing
now? Where are we going? And that's not exciting on a record. Like, on a record, it's cool to just be like, pop, pop. And so we edited in basically more like jump in positions and, like, rigorously cut things that were not, like...
No, I think they were interesting if you were in the room.
Yeah, exactly.
And you were along the ride. If you were with us the whole way through, it made sense. But you're absolutely right. This album is not a documentation.
No, definitely not. And I don't want it to
really
be. I wanted it to be something that sounds like, oh, they got together and recorded this. And one thing that's so good is you guys are so loud. that, like, you don't hear any of the audience. Like, there's nothing of the audience you can hear, I think.
Well, that also speaks to the politeness of our audience, doesn't it?
Yeah, that they didn't come. No tripping glass or anything, no bother. So it was really, it's powerful. And I just wanted to emphasize that with the mixing. And I had this vision, this is something that could have been, like, stylistically recorded, like, 1983 in Coventry or something like mm-hmm. that. So, like, it has a certain vibe to it. It was just cool to just think, this is material now. This is material we can work with and create something that fits the medium of an album. Because I think everything needs to be adapted to the room that it plays in. You can't play fast in a church. You can, but you might just be like... You're running over the echoes. If you're like talking like this in church, nobody's going to hear you. That's why the priest speaks like this.
No, but it's,
so you need to adapt to the room and the medium that you're in, and that's
the
why
same.
It's
if you look at film versus stage, I mean, you were working in a theater for a long time, and if you would just film a stage production.
No.
It doesn't really make sense.
No.
And you notice that sometimes when you watch certain films that, okay, these people are really meant for the stage. You can do so many interesting things in the medium of film. And with recording, it's quite the same if you choose to. You can zoom in. You can pan out. You can make cuts.
And you can create a perspective that someone who hasn't seen the live show would have never been able to hear. Because imagine you've got 16 microphones up there, which are basically microscopes. So you can zoom into every little detail. And that's a perspective no audience member can get. So they're far away. They get the whole thing. But this enabled us in this part. I only want us to hear this. And in this part, this drum sound, it needs to be sculpted out. It dies in the whole thing. But if we pull it up, everything just makes more sense. It makes more impact. And that's the same as like when you see like Glenn Gould like working on his pieces, like in the recording. They're collections of all the best parts and like different microphone positions also. So this, okay, take this, chop, these parts, the perfectionism and the sound design possibilities are endless. When you think about, simply what microphone is now active in this moment? And there are limits, of course. So the first mix, like, that's a little technical detail. My mastering engineer was like, this is out of phase, this is out of phase, this doesn't work, this is out of phase. Out of phase means that all the microphones record everything at the same time because they're all open. So there's limits to what you can do. You're always going to hear a little bit bleed through. And when you change too much, when you go too wild, the phase goes out of whack. So you've got signals that are basically canceling each other out.
Right.
And when you sum it to mono, like when you're basically listening on one speaker, it sounds like or you miss complete parts. So he was, and if you can't put it on a vinyl, because this is out now on vinyl, and there are very specific limits to what you can do in terms of like phase on that medium. So, okay, I went back to the drawing board, took back some of the more extreme things that we did,
okay,
and made it more, okay. And it sounded so much better. It sounded then so much better. I learned so much about mixing like a live recording, which was super interesting because I've never done that. I've never done like a live recording like this. And the best thing like I find is like learning on the job.
Yeah, of course.
So it's like that thing,
doing.
Yeah, not to go into that Zen Buddhist thing, like, but it's like when you, what's like, what does the Zen Buddhist say when you tell me that you've got a problem? That's good for you.
Uh-huh.
So it's like, it's the same thing that my neighbor taught me, like when he was came to this Zen cloister, and they said, you're new. Well, here's the kitchen. And for how many people? Yeah, 100. I've never cooked for 100 people before. Good. So he became a very good cook. So that's like a positive problem to have. Something that's solvable. You know, it's a lot. It seems impossible, but it's solvable. And you figure it out, and you're gonna make burn some dishes, and you're gonna make some people mad because the food tastes horrible. But on the way, you figure it out.
Well, I think you did a very good job. I'm surprised to hear it was your first time actually doing that.
But, no.
Sounds great to me.
No, thank you.
So in a few days, we're going to do a totally new show together.
Yes.
This time at the Alte Oper here in Frankfurt. What do you have planned for us? As of this recording, we start tomorrow morning. So what am I walking into tomorrow morning?
I hope you're not going to walk into the tape loop that's stretched across the front of the stage.
Oh, dear.
Okay. Because that's something I kept. But because it's the second time, I doubled the amount of tape machines. So now there's two. Always go one bigger. So it's two tape machines, one on the left side of the stage, one on the right, and one loop running between them. But this program is something that's based on contact with the music that I had last year that completely inspired me, and that's the work of Chelsea Giacinto, I think. Chelsea, and this was a composer from Italy, did most of his works, I think, in the 1950s, was rediscovered in the 1980s. So, I think, and when I first heard that music, I was amazed because it sounded like electronic music.
Uh-huh.
It sounded, I heard the orchestra play electricity. And I was like, what's happening here? And then I learned about the process because he played an instrument very similar to the one that I I'm playing in this performance, and that's an ondiola, which is basically a proto synthesizer. Like it's a monophonic instrument that is meant to be tucked underneath a keyboard to enable you to play like something akin to a flute or a horn or a cello, and you add it all by punching in little numbers, and then the little filters engage, and then you get a timbre that's supposed to be like a concert instrument. And of course this sounds nothing like it, but it sounds a bit like it. And what he would do after a mental breakdown that he had, he would experiment with the idea of one note. Mm-hmm. He would play endlessly in hotel bars. There he was hanging around, play like one note on a piano. And then he started playing that on this electronic instrument. And then he would sometimes... And then he would record that on tape. And then he would record another layer while playing back from that tape onto a second tape machine. And then he would give the final tape to his collaborator, whose name just right now escapes me. You'll have to dub it in. I can look into it. I'll find it. So, but collaborator basically, or like a composer that he paid for to transcribe it. Sometimes that composer complained he would only get like one note, and then he had to write everything basically. And some, here's a crescendo, and then basically that, he would write basically an orchestra piece from that, from these sketches of early electronic instruments with all their little quirks onto two early tape machines with all their quirks and the process of bouncing. So all these quirks add up into that music. And when you listen to the music, it's, for me, it was absolutely genius because I can hear the wobble of a tape. I can hear the wide vibrato of that machine. I can hear the pitch drift. I can hear the filter switch in the cello, in the flute, in all these instruments all together. So,
but you're talking about the final composition, And in what we're going to be doing tomorrow, if I understand you right, this is even more of an exploration of the process.
Yeah, of course, because I thought, wow, this is cool. This is where I love this process of translation, basically, and what's gained and what is lost. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's called Übersetzungsverstärker, meaning translation amplifier. Yeah. Or something. So it's like it's a very technical term. It's something that doesn't exist, but it fits like the mindset of this. And I basically I'm gonna sit there with my little Hohner Elektronium, which is also a similar early musical instrument from 1948, first used, and of course was used by Stockhausen in the Stockhausen Ensemble, and it is. Similarly strange to the instrument, or similarly out there and modern for the time of the 1950s as the one that Schelze used, but I was really interested to do this process basically live and improvised, to see what happens if I play an idea and you start to improvise on that and imitate what I'm playing and translate it to your own instruments and use that as a starting point for something new. And that's going to be Act 1. And Act 2 of Übersetzungsverstärker is basically that. That cool. is basically, I'm going to play, the first act is really, it's I call it a one note and a not. So it's literally, it's going to be one note and just timbral changes to it. And then allow myself one pitch change. Mm. So, and then we're going to find a way where you take that one note, interpret it on your own instruments, and take it further and further and further. And for the second act, we go to a different, there's many, many little different parts in there. But then I wanted to hit like a point. So Act 3 is us playing together. Act 4 is a part where it's all about the tape itself and the materiality of it. Mm-hmm. And that's a very almost theatrical act, and then there's a little theater drama moments in there, and then we have a little after show party after that.
So I can already tell this is a bit more
it's way more structured, but that structure came from playing, because I've spent so that's again like one situation that I goes back to what I talked earlier. I like to create circumstances where you can create. And I created these circumstances for myself. I set up the system that I was going to play in my cellar. I had the two tape machines left and right to me. I had the Elektronium and my own synthesizer that I built and my software that I made to the right. And then I would start playing. And I played another set. And from these set, I gathered all these ideas. And I had a bunch of ideas, a library of what I can do with this setup. And then I didn't do anything with it for a month and just thought about it. Just thought about what could be fun. And in the last week, I just sat down and said, okay, let's have a proper plan for how this can work and how it can be fun. So because the piece is only 35 minutes, 40 minutes, so it has to be on point. And what are things that I really wanted to do and missed even. There was one thing, like the fourth act where it's playing the materiality of the tape. This is something that I noticed when I watched through like the footage of the rehearsal to last time that we did there. I did that there, but it never went anywhere. We forgot it. I forgot that it happened. I forgot that that moment was there. And I thought, that was too good. Mm. That's such a good moment from last time. We can expand on that. And I wanted to feel a little bit like a play in this time. And that's because all this time of working theater I've composed for like, I don't know, 70, 80, I don't know how many pieces. I love this Aristotelian drama structure. So five acts. So it's completely structured after that.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it's. I think it's. It keeps the excitement, and I think it's a very colorful thing. It literally starts monophonic but then it goes very, very polyphonic. And so this time there's even keys. I've noted keys down. I've noted intensities down and all those things. So it's very, very strict for me.
We're getting technical here. Okay.
No, but the fun thing was, like I said, the fun thing was that I think when I showed that to you, I said, this is very, it's already a lot. And you said, oh, there's still a lot of freedom for improvisation. I was like, oh. Good, that's good, because that's what I want. Because in the end, it's another thing where I really want to improvise and figure something out.
Well, you're not telling me what notes to play. You're telling me everything else. You know what I mean?
No, and I don't want to tell you what notes to play. That feels like the vibe. I want to give you like the world and the vibe. That's more my thing.
And I'm pretty sure that's going to happen. So I'm really looking forward to this week. And Heinbach, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me again.
Primer is now available on most streaming platforms. It's also available as a vinyl record or as a digital download on Heinbach's page on bandcamp.com.
And should be in all record stores also. Like, it's in a lot of record stores.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
That was Nebenstimmen, a podcast by Ensemble Modern.